Null Zeit by Scott Harrison. A great man once told me that every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It just doesn't have to be in that order. For me, this story really all began 2 decades earlier on a festive pub crawl around Tokyo when I first met Haruko Ohtaka. For others involved in this tale, it began a few thousand years ago when a star in a neighbouring galaxy went supernova. But for you, the story begins somewhere in the middle. It's not that the beginning is irrelevant or unimportant, or that you won't be told about those earlier times. Well, you'll be told about the supernova. As for my drunken antics, they're really none of your business. What I mean is, you'll be given the appropriate details in good time. But to start any earlier would be a waste of time, especially as this is only a short story and time is of the essence. So, for you the story will begin on board a spaceship with curator Resef Masri and the bird. The cuckoo shrike wasn't real. I noticed this the moment I stepped into the geodesic dome. It was a tiny, intricate automaton with an outer casing constructed of a tough polycarbide and steel mix. A colourful bit of nonsense designed, no doubt, with the intention to delight and amuse the Starliner passengers.
It's actually a rather good facsimile of the Coruscina Novae Hollandi,
Masri told me, his chalk blue eyes studying the miniature avian droid as it settled on the branch of a nearby bow tree.
The captain had it commissioned from a delightfully odd little toy maker on the Tethys colony.
It was warm inside the geodesic dome, the air stale and undisturbed like the inside of a greenhouse. There was even an artificial odour of damp soil and bird droppings, which was a rather nice touch. It almost made me feel homesick. We crossed over the stream via a small stone bridge, elegant arches of panelled glass curving high above our heads, intensifying the pulsing pale blue light of the nearby binary star system.
Ah, the mighty Pyramus and Thisbe,
Masri purred, stopping a few paces behind me, face turned up towards the cascade of blue starlight.
They sit out here on the edge of the Terran space like ancient marker boys. From this point onwards, we enter the hinterland. In my country, we call it Al-Zalam Al-Ezim. A rough translation would be the Great Dark.
He chuckled softly.
My people have always had a penchant for the romantic.
You said you had an urgent message for me from my friend Haruko. Perhaps you could get to the point? I didn't mean to be so short. Masri seemed a perfectly pleasant, if somewhat vague, little man, as far as I could tell. Although, to be fair, I'd only known him for roughly 13 minutes, so I was hardly the expert. Maybe I was more tired than I realised. That's why my temper was so foul, my nerves so frayed. God knows, the rhythms of the day were all wrong. Less than 24 hours ago, I was cataloguing a cluster of ancient orbiting temples in the Aegis system. Then suddenly, I'm being summoned to the Brindisi Star by a complete stranger who claims to be the head curator of the Cairo Archive, and we're heading for the Tipler Nebula. Beside me, Masri had fallen silent, hands clasped neatly behind his back as he watched a gardening droid bobbing high above the dark canopy of trees. At last, the little man said,
"For the past 3 days, my home has been on Ulkesh, working alongside your friend, Dr. Ohtaka. The colony is a pleasant place, or at least it was."
The gardening droid dropped down through the trees and hovered a meter or so in front of us, its optical sensors scrutinizing a branch of withered brown leaves. A pair of secateurs slid from the droid's spherical casing and snipped away the dead section of branch from the tree.
"Of all the places I have been sent by the Earth Antiquities Committee, Ulkesh is the one that troubles me the most. From the moment we set up the terraforming complex at the Southern Pole, I have had this feeling. Just here."
And he tapped the base of his neck, an inch or so below the line of his peppered grey hair.
"I believe you would call them the hackles." just like the cat when he senses that something is amiss.
And what about Haruko? Did she have the same feelings about Ulkesh?
Ah, the good Dr. Otaka,
he exclaimed, flashing me a full set of pearly whites.
Yes, she too felt that way after a while. She was the first, in fact, where all our problems began.
Her work started the trouble.
I wasn't quite making the connection. It was true that ever since I'd known her, Haruko had always been obsessive about her work, bordering on the point of neurosis. For her, trying to understand the behaviour of a long-dead alien culture was almost a compulsion. But never had she let her passion become so consuming that it had clouded her better judgments. Never had she been anything short of considerate, well-intentioned and diplomatic. I've always hated the term team player. It strikes me as twee and condescending, but that's exactly what Haruko was. When Haruko had been a little girl, growing up in Ishikawa, she had been given the nickname Komorebi by her parents. Once, when we had gotten stinking drunk on a crate of Phobian wine on a jaunt back from the Scarlet Cluster, she told me that in Japan the word meant sunbeams through the leaves. I'd laughed. She'd turned a very dark and extremely mortified crimson. As far as I was concerned, anyone with a nickname like that would never start trouble on a scientific survey colony.
I think you need to tell me everything,
I told him after a moment's deliberation. I haven't heard from Haruko for a long time. Masri had obviously been thinking the very same thing.
Yes, absolutely. There is something that I need you to hear anyway. Something that I have not played to a single soul since I received it a few days ago.
Masri's cabin was in the steerage section, halfway down a dimly lit narrow corridor which seemed to bend and twist in all directions like tunnels in a rabbit warren. The air felt much colder after the stilted heat of the dome. He opened the door with a battered metal key slug and ushered me inside. As the door shushed closed behind us, Masri scurried off, disappearing into the gloom. The floor lights flickered slowly to life. In the dirty orange glow, I could see Masri's vague diminutive shape hunched over the communication console, hands fluttering across the controls like the wings of the tiny avian droid. He waved a hand, beckoning me to join him at the comms unit.
What you are about to hear is part of a message sent to me via the EAC network a few weeks ago. Most of the transmission was nothing more than a garbled mess of white noise, static and electromagnetic interference, but there were fragments of...
He paused, his eyes dark and unfathomable in the grubby glow of the floor lights.
Well, you can hear for yourself.
There was a howl of static. Then below that, faint and scared, a voice.
I don't know what day this is. I don't know where I am or how I got here. There's no time here, no passage of days or hours or minutes. I can't even see the stars anymore. They're all blotted out by the distraction. In our hubris, we've brought about Armageddon. I'm so scared. So scared of... God help us all!
Masri stood with his head turned away from me, looking out of the viewport at the scattering of cold stars frozen in blackness. I gave things some thought before asking my next question. And that was Haruko? Masri turned and regarded me with those pale blue eyes, and just for a second, he seemed sad and a little lost. Then he smiled, and the sadness was gone.
Yes, I believe it was our mutual friend, Dr. Otaka.
I've never heard Haruko sound so scared, I said. What exactly is happening out there on Ulkesh?
That is a very difficult question to answer,
Masri said, and there was a twinge of reticence in his voice.
When I left the colony some 10 months ago, I was beginning to see some changes in my colleagues' behavior.
I stared at the little man for a moment. Eventually I said, what kind of changes? With a sigh, Masri said,
I think you'd better sit down, Miss Summerfield. I will pour us both a drink and tell you the whole story from the beginning.
This is where things start to get a little complicated, or at least somewhat apocryphal. You see, the story that Masri told me in his cabin was one I found eminently fascinating at the time, but in retrospect, troubles me greatly. Much of what he told me was based in truth, or at least the truth as he saw it. But since then, I have visited the subterranean library vaults on Tarrakeen and attempted to piece together the histories for myself. And very little of it matches or bears out Masri's version. I don't think that he was being purposefully devious or misleading. No, I suspect that what was happening on Ulkesh had affected him too, to a certain degree. Once upon a time, so the age-old cliché goes, a star located 2.5 million light-years away in the nearby Andromeda galaxy went nova. For those who don't know which direction that is, just point the nose of your spaceship towards Drexel 3, keep going for roughly 9 light-years, then take a sharp left at the first cluster of Dyson spheres. Some astrohistorians believe that the star may have gone hypernova, which was why, approximately 2,500 years ago, it was visible in the night skies of our own planet. For those civilizations living on the worlds orbiting that star, it meant total and utter extinction. For those civilizations living on Earth, particularly those congregating in a city located on a certain plateau in the Judean Mountains, it meant something quite different. This star, thought to have been named Jardish by those living on the fourth planet, a name that somewhat ironically meant the Constant One in their ancient tongue, came to be known in Earth history as the Christmas Star, and its destruction hailed the coming of the Messiah. Astrohistorians often refer to this as Nullzeit, zero time. In the years since its appearance in our skies, a brand spanking new religion was forged. A religion that brought with it enlightenment, exaltation, reformation, persecution, division and war, not to mention the biggest selling book in all of Terran space. After the star exploded, it was replaced by a cloud composed of dust, helium, hydrogen and various ionized gases, and over time this cloud was given a name. The Tipler Nebula. Fascinating stuff, right? Well, it's all important, so pay attention and bear with me. The Tipler Nebula. A name originally given to it by a very particular group of astrohistorians who had become interested in studying the origins of the universe from the creationism point of view. I'm sure you've already guessed it, but this was Masri's mob. There was just over 150 of them altogether, including my friend Haruko. So fascinated were these astrohistorians by the idea that the Jardish hypernova had been the star seen in the biblical story of the Nativity, they decided to set up a colony on the nearby planet of Ulkesh. The only trouble was, Ulkesh was a howling, desolate, inhospitable void of a place that couldn't support human life. So, a terraforming station was set up on its northern pole, while the scientists built a small prefabricated habitation complex on its surface. But what made this little colony so different, so unique, and therefore so interesting, was the orbiting scientific research platform known as Horizon. Surrounding the planet like a series of fine cracks across an egg's shell, at a distance of roughly 7,000 kilometres above the surface, the Horizon platform housed a number of laboratories, whether in environmental control stations, and the first experimental TIS, or Total Immersion Suite, an immense hologrammatic room ostensibly used for research purposes, in which the scientists could create, control, and manipulate simulated alien worlds and their environments. Neat idea, right? The scientists thought so too. So much so that, according to Masri, they were starting to retreat from reality, spending more and more time at the TIS, away from their fellow colleagues. Life in the colony had become far from harmonious, with opinions differing wildly and tempers running hot, A schism had occurred, creating a split so wide that it was in danger of growing into a chasm. The division had started over a disagreement on how the story of the Nativity should be interpreted. One group, led by Haruko Otaka, believed that the arrival of the Messiah was actually the scouting party for a proposed alien invasion and colonization. The other believed that Jesus was actually the first in a brand new evolutionary strain of human being, the Homo superior, or the superhuman. When Masri left the colony 10 months ago, both groups were busily reprogramming the TIS in an attempt to test their theories and to prove the other group wrong. Less than 3 months later, all communication with the colony stopped. Okay, so that's what Masri told me. The next part of the story is where things start to get a little weird. But there's nothing I can do about that. We're about to tumble down the rabbit hole as far as reality and memory is concerned. What happened, happened, and I'm going to tell it like it was. Or at least like it was to me at the time. Even though some of it happened and some of it probably didn't happen. Confused? Good. Then I'm telling it right. After I left Masri's cabin, I was unsure what to do. I tried sleeping, but it wasn't easy. The sleeper machines were too intrusive, too uncomfortable, and the way they talked to you during hibernation really freaked me out, so I decided to take a walk along the promenade. All the onboard passenger signs referred to it as the Star Deck, but really it was just a mile and a half of paved walkway that ran alongside a few tinted viewports. And now that the binary star system was behind us, the view was far from spectacular. After that, I went down to the lifesuit bay to prepare for planetfall. There were more people using the bay than I'd been expecting, and it took a little time before one of the crew was free to show me how to get into the suit.
The trick is that we wake it in such a way that it doesn't get upset,
the crewman told me. His badge proclaimed him to be one able starman Mervyn Gant, but he looked more like a Walter to me, or a Neville.
These things are so temperamental. The last thing you need in a hostile alien environment is a moody lifesuit.
A thin black fibrous strand had reached out from the metal container on the wall and wrapped itself around my wrist. It was warm and clammy and felt a little like smooth, hairless, featureless skin. Slowly the material built itself around me, causing me to shift uncomfortably as it spread down my body towards my groin and onto my legs.
The trick is not to panic,
Mervyn explained, detecting my unease. There's a lot of tricks to this, isn't there? I attempted to say. But the life suit material chose that moment to spread itself across my mouth, muffling the words and rendering them practically unintelligible. Mervyn offered me a somewhat bemused smile then, all the time nodding his head in mock sympathy, as though some gibbering idiot had wandered into the life suit bay and spoken to him in a strange, nonsensical language. That's when I heard the voice. It seemed to be whispering softly in my ear. No, not in my ear. The voice was coming from somewhere inside my head. Don't struggle. Just relax. It'll all be over in a second or two. Don't fight it. Let it just flow over you. It was like a low-pitched hum at the base of my skull, soft and soothing, yet vaguely irritating too, like an angry wasp trapped in a glass. Please, Professor Summerfield. This will be much more pleasant if you stop struggling. You may even find the experience familiar. And it was true. The sensation was familiar. It was like running. We were running, legs pounding as we crested the hill, feet crunching awkwardly through thick, freshly fallen snow. Curator Resef Masri was by my side, similarly suited up in semi-sentient black as we paused to take in the landscape that stretched away on all sides like a giant's board game. It was Christmas here on Ulkesh, which was a little odd, seeing as it was only May when I'd left Earth on the Brindisi Star. Somehow, 7 months had slipped past me. The more I tried to remember, the more the memories seemed to run off and hide. The last thing I could remember with any clarity was the lifesuit bay and Mervyn, or Walter or Neville. I remember the clammy, skin-like feel as I donned the lifesuit. I don't think I'll ever forget that. Then Masri had entered the bay, and Mervyn had given him the same spiel about the trick being not to upset the suit, and that the trick was also not to panic, blah, blah, blah. So many tricks, he said, just like I had, as the black material slowly began to twine itself around his body. It's eating him, I thought, and for some reason that made me giggle. The Brindisi star had refused to orbit the planet, something about it being too dangerous due to the recent outbreak of hostilities. It was a shame, they'd said, especially at this festive time of year. We were marched instead to the shuttle bay and bundled on board a drone ship. But before we left, Mervyn did something very odd. Something that had been troubling me ever since. He pulled on a colourful, chunky knitted sweater, donned a paper party hat, and wished us both a Merry Christmas. It said, "I'm a gangster rapper," on his Christmas jumper. Rapper spelt with a W. I must have spoken the words out loud, because when I looked over at Masri, he was giving me the same worried stare someone might give a rabid Koloth beast just seconds before it leapt for the kill. "He was wearing a Christmas jumper," I explained quickly, so he didn't think I'd suddenly gone gaga. "The crewman on the Brindisi Star."
"Perhaps because it's Christmas," the little man answered, pointing down towards the prefabricated colony domes sitting huddled in the valley below us.
Multicoloured fairy lights hung from every roof and shone from every window, while at the very centre of the complex a huge evergreen conifer tree stood, decorated with Christmas lights and topped by a large glowing golden star. In the light of the grey winter morning, with the snow falling steadily, the colony complex looked like a tiny, intricately painted model inside a child's snow globe. That's when I saw them, about 500 yards ahead, ploughing through the snow just beyond the domes. The lifesuit's proximity tracker picked up their heat signatures and immediately relayed the information to my visor screen. 14 unidentified objects detected approximately 6 clicks to the northwest, it informed me, a slight note of panic and alarm in its voice. I advise getting a shift on before they see us. From a distance, the machines looked like armoured walkers of some kind. It wasn't until we got closer, or to be more precise, they got closer to us, that I realised they were reindeer. Battle-armoured cyborg reindeer, to be precise. I did warn you that things were going to get a little weird, didn't I? As I watched, the rider at the front of the pack kicked at his augmented animal's flanks with the heels of his snow boots and tugged on the reins, causing the creature to swing around in our direction. With a sudden lurch, the cyborg sprang forward, carrying its rider towards us. The rider, I noticed, was wearing a red fur-trimmed Santa hat. "We've been spotted," I shouted towards my companion, though my words were mostly drowned out by the shattering thud of a creeping barrage that had begun firing from somewhere behind the distant ridge. But Masri wasn't moving. He was standing absolutely still in the snow beside me, his eyes wide, arm outstretched and pointing towards the approaching creature.
"But it just cannot be,"
he stammered, as I grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and half-shoved, half-carried him in the direction of a nearby trench.
"This is not the time for sightseeing, Masri," I shouted in his ear.
Yet still the little man continued to struggle, his eyes never straying from the approaching reindeer.
"But you don't understand. I know that man."
The man that he recognised, along with over 3,000 pounds of cyborg reindeer, thundered past as I managed to push him over the edge into the trench with myself following not far behind.
"I told you, didn't I? Didn't I tell you? Get a shift on," I said. "I told you they'd spot us standing out on top of the snowbank like that."
There was real panic in the lifesuit's voice now, and I remembered Merving telling me that the last thing I needed in a hostile alien environment was a moody life suit.
Just calm down. We're okay now. We're out of harm's way. I tried to sound as calm and reassuring as I could, but I wasn't sure it was working.
Beside me, Masri stared in disbelief.
That was a flying reindeer.
Yes, it was, I said, sounding a lot calmer than I felt.
A flying cyborg reindeer with guns built into its horns.
I nodded. I did notice that, yes.
He was wearing a Santa hat.
It was at that moment that I realised that this wasn't an archaeological trench we were in, or a trench dug on an allotment somewhere ready for a row of potatoes or carrots. This was a trench. A war trench. There was mud and barbed wire and sandbags and dead bodies. The creeping barrage started up again, slamming into the ground only yards away from the trench. A geyser of mud and snow erupted over us, knocking me backwards, and I fell headlong over Masri. There was another explosion, even closer this time, followed by another, and then a third, each one rocking the trench and causing fountains of snow and earth to pour down on us. A warning alarm began to sound inside my lifesuit, followed by a panicky voice. I strongly advise you that you move to safety immediately. If this mud were to bury you alive, I only have enough oxygen to sustain you for approximately 5 hours. Taking advantage of the lull in the bombardment, I lurched unsteadily to my feet, grabbing Masri by the hand and pulling him along behind me. Water sloshed beneath the duckboards as we ran along the trench, hoping to find some sort of shelter. But there was none. Our only chance was to climb up over the parapet of the trench and head away from the shelling, and hope that we didn't get shot once we were out in the open. Masri went first. It took him a while to drag himself up over the top, but my shoulder wedged against his backside soon helped. All the time, he was muttering under his breath that this wasn't right, that nothing about any of this made sense. I certainly wasn't in the mood to argue. Instead, I pulled myself up out of the trench, and together we half ran, half stumbled towards the smoking ruins of a prefab dome 100 yards away. The ruins weren't empty. Among the scattered bodies and the debris stood the ragged survivors of the devastation. They seemed barely alive, their clothes nothing more than torn rags, their faces emaciated and feral. They were warming their hands around what looked like a pile of burning Christmas trees, and their dark, hollow eyes regarded us with suspicion and dread as we approached. Something jangled tunelessly beneath my boot, causing me to stop. Carefully, I lifted my foot. There on the ground, gyrating pathetically in the dust, was the remains of a wind-up dancing snowman.
"Don't touch it," said one of the faces through the flames. "It could be booby-trapped."
As I stepped gingerly over the Christmas ornament, Masri gave a gasping sob and stumbled forward, hand outstretched as though he were waking from a dream.
"Horst!"
he exclaimed, staring at one of the emaciated wretches that stood warming his hands over the fire.
"My God, man, what has happened here?"
At first the man showed no sign of acknowledgement. Then, slowly, the fear that shone from his eyes began to dim as he recognised the little curator.
"Resef, you should not have come here,"
Horst answered sadly.
"I thought you were free of this living hell."
"But how did this happen?"
The emaciated wretch pointed a skeletal finger towards the battlefield.
"They started this. They found something. It should have stayed buried. They had no business digging it up. But they did, and it started all this."
I followed the direction of Horst's crooked digit. In the thick of the battle, giant robot camels strode high above the devastation, energy beams shooting from their eyes in long spirals of white and pink. The camels were crying peppermint candy canes over the battlefield. I tapped Masri on the shoulder.
Are you seeing this?"
But he wasn't listening. All his attention was on Horst and the other scientists that circled the fire.
"What did they find, Horst?"
It was at that moment that a figure shuffled out from behind the fire. The same person who had warned me not to step on the dancing snowman. It took me a moment to register who it was. As she shambled towards me, I noticed she was smiling. But it was a smile in name only. There was no warmth in it. No feeling. Just a series of muscle flexes and contractions. It was the Christmas angel, Benny. It fell out of the sky, all the way from heaven. And now all the armies have gathered for the great battle. It's Armageddon. Everything was just like in a bad movie. The death, the destruction, the devastation, the giant robot camels shooting out deadly candy canes. And now, in amongst all this hell, was my friend Haruka Otaka, my little Komarebi, one of my oldest friends, my regular drinking buddy and late-night relationship confidant. She looked barely alive, lurching through the rubble towards me like one of the living dead. And when she reached out and took my hand, her skin was so cold to the touch that it took my breath away. I know what you're thinking. Flying cyborg reindeer, giant robot camels and exploding snowmen ornaments. It doesn't sound like any Christmas you can remember. It sounds like something that didn't really happen. But it was happening then. So I took Haruko's hand and went with her to see the Christmas angel. We walked for what seemed like hours across the blood-soaked battlefields. All the time the snow fell thick and silent, adding a sort of festive spirit to the grim and brutal proceedings. Haruko walked beside me and Masri in silence, like a warped version of the ghost of Christmas present. Where there should have been hope, there was desperation and conflict. Where there should have been cheerfulness, there was sickness and death. What should have felt as welcoming as home felt like the strangest and most alien of lands. We saw groups of soldiers, wounded and dying, trying to keep their spirits up by singing Christmas carols around a lifeless, pitiful excuse for a tree that was hung with multicoloured Christmas lights, many of which were broken and dark. We stood upon the crest of a hill and watched an encampment called New Bethlehem, far below in the valley, fall beneath the relentless onslaught of the giant stomping robot camels. Masri sat upon a rock and wept as the screams of the families inside were suddenly cut off as the pressure dome fell and the walkers moved in for the kill. And then suddenly, we were there. At an underground lab complex, as if it had sneaked up on us while our backs were turned. I won't bore you with the details about the long, boring ride down in the elevator, or the endless, boring security checkpoints we had to stop at along the way. It'd just bore you. And I won't tell you about the gingerbread doors that lined the underground corridor, or the tiny pointed-eared elves that scurried past at regular intervals, dressed in equally tiny green fur-trimmed costumes and floppy Christmas hats, because you would think I had gone mad. But every moving part of every piece of technology, from the simplest lock to the most sophisticated computer terminal, was made of wood, and its inner workings turned and spun and chugged just like a giant clockwork mechanism. I won't mention that the security lab had the words Santa's Workshop, Top Secret, stenciled on the door. I won't even mention how dark it was when we stepped inside, or tell you about the angel I saw there when the lights finally sprang to life. No, actually, I will tell you about that, because it's relevant to the story. I'll even tell you that it wasn't really an angel. It was something much, much more impossible. Remarkable, isn't it? Haruko gushed, reaching out to stroke the creature's wing. The soft, leathery skin rippled in disgust at the touch. It was held in force clamps at the very centre of the room, wings pinned open either side of its body, so they couldn't be used as weapons should anyone get too close. Masri stood transfixed, watching the scene in complete horror, so I gave him a gentle nudge of encouragement in the shoulder blades, and he reluctantly shuffled forward into the room. "Don't be afraid," I said. "It won't hurt you."
"How can you be so sure?" he asked.
Because impossible creatures that don't exist can't hurt you, I told him. And this one is quite impossible, preposterous, in fact. The creature gave a gasping, wheezing cough and opened its eyes. The irises a shimmering, shifting field of gold, which both captivated and horrified.
I bring the gifts of blinding light and impenetrable darkness,
it slathered through thick, leathery lips.
Of smothering heat and bitterest cold. Step forward and know me better.
There was nothing fascinating or in the slightest bit captivating about the creature's words, yet Masri seemed compelled to take a couple of doubtful steps forward.
Don't you think you're laying it on a bit thick?
I said, and just for a second the creature shifted nervously in its harness. Even without the heaps of turkeys and mince pies gathered around your feet, I'd say you were starting to push your luck. Haruko's fingers paused mid-stroke, fingertips hovering above the ripping skin. What do you mean?
Oh, come on. It's all getting a bit self-reverential now, don't you think? Come in and know me better, man. That thing's getting its nativity mixed up with his Dickens.
There was a flicker of confusion in Haruko's eyes.
I don't know what you mean.
You don't? I would have thought you, of all people, would have understood. A Christmas angel? And I'm Puff the Magic Dragon.
But I am the Christmas angel,
the creature boomed.
I am the bringer of blinding.
Ah, shut it, sunshine, I said, cutting it off before we got the whole spiel for a second time.
The only thing you are is a figment of her childhood. I stepped closer to Haruko.
Don't you see it yet? You should. You grew up with it.
Understanding burned in Haruko's eyes now as the light started coming on inside her head.
The book? She managed to stammer. That's it. It's right out of the pages of your favourite children's book, The Atlas of Made-Up Lands and the Things That Live There. Do you remember now?
Slowly, Haruko nodded.
She did remember, which meant that she knew what the creature was now. It's called a Chenchi, I said, or at least it would be if it were real.
It is real, Masri insisted. You can see it for yourself. It was this creature, or another of its species, that visited Earth nearly 2,500 years ago. This is what the shepherds in the Nativity saw. Haruko and her team were right. The Messiah was an alien sent to Earth to seed the planet with its own kind.
I shook my head. No one was right. The Chenchi are folklore, a fairy tale. Oh, tell him, Haruko.
The Chenchi are no more real than the Tooth Fairy, she said slowly.
But it is here,
Masri said, although it sounded like he couldn't quite believe his own eyes.
It is standing right in front of us.
Oh, come on, Resef. Have you not figured out where we are yet?
I asked, giving him an encouraging clap on the shoulder. A Christmas war being fought on the surface of Ulkesh between cyborg reindeer and giant robot camels? Exploding dancing snowmen and Christmas angels? Isn't it obvious? But apparently it wasn't obvious, despite the absurdity of the situation. So I explained it to him. None of this was real. Hadn't been for some time, in fact, but the truth of it had been hidden from us, on purpose. You see, somewhere along the line, we'd become trapped inside the total immersion suite. Of course, the TIS isn't supposed to hide itself from you like that. It's supposed to tick along in the background, crouching on the edge of your perception threshold, so that you always know you're inside a hologrammatic simulation, although the knowledge isn't shouting at you loud enough to spoil the believability of the experience. But Haruko and her mob had been tampering with the threshold levels, That's why things were somewhat hazy about our arrival on Ulkesh. Why we saw bizarre things, like Mervyn in his Christmas jumper. Our minds were being reprogrammed by the TIS as it attempted to hide itself from us. Let's rewind a little. When Masri and I had arrived on Ulkesh, via a normal passenger shuttle, no automatic drone ship, no Christmas jumpers and party hats, we'd found the colony abandoned and without power. We'd taken the space elevator up to the horizon, which was seemingly empty and powered down to its lowest base settings. Heat and life support had been shut off, its orbital jets only idling. Then we'd found that the scientists were inside the TIS, but its core program had been rewritten, altered and tampered with so many times that it had become confused and almost schizophrenic. Unable to restart the Horizon's core system, we decided that the only thing to do was to enter the TIS and find Haruko. Well, you know the rest. Every story has an end. Except perhaps this one. I'd like to say that it ended how it started. On board a spaceship, with a tiny avian droid, with all the scientists from Ulkesh being carried to safety. But it doesn't. For the colony on Ulkesh, it hasn't ended. It seems that the nearby Tipler Nebula had been causing a stimulation of their aggressive tendencies. We only just managed to wrangle Haruko away. So we've left the rest of them there, inside the TIS. Safe for the time being, although we've programmed a much less destructive hologrammatic simulation for them to exist inside. We've taken away the Christmas elements for a start, and given it more of a summer holiday vibe. There's sun, sand, and a seafood buffet. All things that are, we hope, harder to quarrel over than the trappings of Christmas. How long they will be in there, I can't say. Masri is trying to secure funding for research into some kind of reflective shield to deflect the harmful radiation before anyone tries to extract them. Haruko is having specialised medical care, and I'm staying with her in the hospital. She's far too weak and confused to talk to all you journalists. That's why you've got me instead. I hope I've explained everything properly. I've certainly done my best. Now, are there any questions?